The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks. Or welcome back, I should say. Yeah, you're with Brett King. I'm your host. And this week, we're going to be talking about this, the marriage of analog and digital a little bit, some of the changes that are taking place. We're going to kick off with that. Also, we've got a couple of visitors, global visitors or guests joining us on the show today. One who's calling, David Thomas, is calling in bright and early from Canberra, actually, in Australia, where he is today on his travels. And we've got also Anders joining us in a moment. But just in respect to, we had some really great feedback from the crowd in terms of the Neobank show we had last week with Josh and, of course, with Patrick from Soon. A lot of really interesting feedback and a lot of good discussion and debate on that, particularly the social elements around Soon and what they were sort of introducing there. Very, very interesting stuff. So great to see that, you know, we're definitely right in the thick of this in terms of development and changes right now. It's great to see there's still lots of healthy discussion. The acquisition of Simple by BBVA is certainly not the end of the chapter here. It's definitely the start. So very, very exciting times. Anyway, let me get to our first guest. Anders Salmon-Nielsen is a pal. We've been working together for a couple of years, but Anders has just recently launched his latest book, which is called DigiLog. Anders is actually, I don't know how to describe him, half Australian, half Swedish. Is that right, Anders?
It's a good description. It's a good fusion.
A bit of a fusion. He has his own consultancy called Think, which is with a Q-U-E instead of with a K. He also is, he's been involved in TED globally. He's a well-respected keynote speaker. But DigiLog is actually the reason I wanted to get him on the show today. DigiLog, the subtitle of which is How to Win the Digital Minds and Analog Hearts of Tomorrow's Customer. It's a very interesting look at this merger between the digital life and the analog life, and how there's elements of the trends where some analog elements sort of come to the fore or continue to survive, whereas some digital elements are extremely disruptive. So Anders has been exploring this over the last few months and is really a central a subtext to or central premise behind his book DigiLog. So Anders, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brett. Good to be with you from Stockholm today.
So you do a lot of travel, but it's good to hear you're in Stockholm. So it's not too late there. It's early evening there. Tell us about DigiLog and what took you, in terms of your journey, what took you to DigiLog as a book, and why you felt the need, or what led to this creation.
Cool. Well, I'll start a little bit with the personal story behind the book, but then relate it back to the idea of banking and retail banking specifically. For the last 8 years, I've, in my management consultancy, been advising large-scale business, Dow Jones and Fortune 500 companies, on how to strategize for future disruption. And then when I sat down to think about one particular piece of disruption, or what I call digital disruption, some people call it digital Darwinism, a world where only the most adaptive will survive, I took a hard look at my own sort of background and reflected on a business very close to my heart, which is my mum's bricks and mortar menswear retail store here in Stockholm. It's 98 years of age. My mum is the third generation owner-operator of this store. And they keep doing the same thing as they always have. She continues doing exactly in terms of marketing, in terms of customer service, what she learned from her father and his father before that. And the challenge is that the customer has moved on. And one of the key arguments here in the book is that increasingly the customer has moved on because our minds, our rational minds that crave information and that make very rational decisions has moved beyond my mum's value proposition, i.e. the customer today has already done their digital due diligence. They've price shopped online. And when they come into her bricks and mortar or her branch, as it were, they've already compared her items. They know what the curation of her brands look like. And they know exactly the deals they can get next door or online.
So they don't actually, they don't come in to shop, they come in to buy.
I mean, essentially, her shop has turned into a showroom for eBay or Amazon.com/fashion, right? And so she's showrooming, which is the sort of plight of many retailers, including retail banks today.
Okay. So in terms of the Digilog message, you know, is it about understanding where the analog presents a benefit versus digital?
Yeah, I mean, I tell my clients, large and small, and I must say, you know, my mum is my toughest pro bono client, Brett. And she always says, hey, Anders, I should be a pro bono client because you're a really annoying child. And I don't think when you've got a futurist as your son that it gets any better with age, right?
True.
But the message and the question.
My dad always jokes that when I'm doing my speaking stuff, he says he should get royalties because he taught me to speak after all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not a nice sort of lagging commissions many years later, right? So you know, the question I always ask of my mum and also you know my MNC clients is what touch points with your clients can be digitized, and are there any that can never be digitized or maybe should never be digitized because you're actually adding value through the face-to-face? And many companies and brands are not making a deliberate choice of which bits they should digitize and which bits maybe they should keep, because there might be instances where focusing on the shiny new penny of the digital world might actually be forcing you to be at the bleeding edge rather than the leading edge. And I think with all of this digital disruption, you know, brands, including retail banks, need to be really careful that they don't throw away the analog baby with the digital bathwater.
So, I mean, what's the process? How do you figure out where, you know, there's something that's adding real value versus something that's just a process that you're used to? Because the biggest challenge in the banking space is not that, you know, the face-to-face element still necessarily provides value. Undoubtedly, for some customers, it does. But more often than not, you know, the reason we end up in the branch to sign a piece of paper is because the bank insists that we're there rather than the fact that it's the way we want to or that necessarily as a consumer, that's how we want to do this. So how do you determine whether it's just you know, wishful thinking on the part of the retail outlet that people still want to come into their physical space versus the reality of making sure that when customers do want to come in, that they get the right service and the right product and, you know, the right process. But when they don't, they have that option.
I think a very clever man once said that, you know, banking as a process will never go away, but banks as institutions may well do. And I think you put it in a similar way, saying, you know, banking as a verb is something we'll always need, but the bank as a noun or as a place, as a physical place, may not be something we need. And, you know, I think this gets people thinking about, hey, banking as a mere utility of shifting ones zeros around the planet, environment where we feel like a bank, where someone adds value beyond just the transaction and the commodity, which is similar to, you know, being just a utility company or a telecommunications company that just shifts information from one account to another. And there, I think every bank brand has a real decision point, which is which bits should we totally commoditize and should we thus maybe digitize in the digital world, and which bits should we decommoditize by having a fantastic branch presence or adding value both in the analog and the digital worlds.
Right. So we're just having a little bit of audio trouble, Anders, but it's not so bad that we won't persist here, but we just had a few dropouts in the last conversation, but we'll bear with it and we'll see how we go. In terms of the process here, how do you actually make that distinction? How do you make distinction of a physical process that's adding real considerable value versus just something that is a process that is historically there? How do you actually determine whether or not the analog process is salvageable?
I think one of the things that I've heard you speak about and some of our certain amounts of friction that exist, and this could be caused by things like channel conflict, like, you know, a mortgage, for example, in terms of meeting the KPIs and the sales targets of an organization have to be signed for by a signature. And this may have to happen in branch, but partly that is as a result of channel conflict. Now, there's also an opportunity.
That channel conflict occurs primarily because of the metrics, right? Because of how internally the bank is valuing things. Like if you take internet, for example, and this is, I guess, the problem that the retail businesses had with this. They initially thought that retail would generate traffic into the branch, right, or into the store. And yet people, you know, organizations like Amazon have come along and shown that actually, you know, you can deliver, a great storefront experience digitally, create massive revenue, and there's definitely a competing revenue situation there. But when someone is stuck in that method of, well, we've always had customers come in the store, and then they're looking at a competing channel, then often the concern is, well, you know, we're going to lose all this business coming in the front door. And so there's a resistance to making that switch. But that is the very thing that allows a digital pure play competitor who's really competent at digital revenue to come in and disrupt you. So, you know, how do you balance that out? How do you balance out the fact that there's just that inertia and that friction with the old system versus actually investing in new to see whether or not it's going to generate new customers, new revenue opportunities?
Well, I mean, I ran into Jeff Bezos at TED Global a few years ago, and Jeff says something really intelligent, which is, if anybody ever has to pick up a phone and call us, call a human being, i.e. their call center line, something has failed in our process. And the question they ask themselves, enjoying this benefit of not having all of this legacy infrastructure of branches, for example, is that they could go, hey, you know, what are all the bits about the customer touch points that we could digitize and optimize without any human touch points? And that's a huge benefit to someone like a digital disruptor, like an Amazon. Now, in terms of a bank brand, they need to start figuring out how they can educate their clients to spend more time digitally and optimize that way, but also align their incentives and the rewards and their sales targets accordingly so that the channels are not in conflict, just like Jeff Bezos alludes to. You know, our customer call center shouldn't have to pick up the slack because someone in IT didn't figure out the process of how a sale should happen.
Right. And that's, there's some good examples of that today where actually, you know, there's a predilection towards having someone come in and sign a signature card for opening an account because, well, we've verified them. They've walked into a branch and presented an identity document. But, you know, that is a huge hurdle to conversion. Right. And, you know, with the right data sets these days, we can easily, just as easily, if not more accurately, in many cases, identify a customer. So are you just putting unnecessary friction in the way of the customer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, when I've been doing strategy consulting with credit unions and retail banks, we often speak about this idea of, yes, it's digilog. We need to find the convergence between the digital world and the analog world and really win the increasingly information-seeking digital minds of the customer. Think mint.com, for example. But we also need to connect with them in the analog world to create loyalty as well. Curiously, it's been shown recently in the United States that frequent mobile bankers are actually more loyal to their preferred retail bank than non-frequent mobile bankers. So many banks are afraid of moving into the digital world, but we're actually seeing frequent mobile bankers, consumers, being more loyal when they're loyal in the digital world.
Mm, yeah, that's interesting. So tell me about the book and tell us a little bit more about the content and the case studies you've got in Digilog. Anders?
Yep, I'm still here.
Sorry. Tell us a bit more about the book and some of the case studies and work you've got in the book in Digilog.
Well, one of the things I think that will appeal to you as well, Brett, is I talk a little bit about mint.com, right? And I was at a conference in New York just the other week on simplification. And at this conference, I spoke a little bit about mint.com. Now, what mint.com has done is they're starting to really appeal to the consumer's increasingly digitized rational mind by serving up visualized information in real time about our spend, our investments, etc. Now, this is a really good example of how a brand can stay at the forefront of a consumer's mind by offering a really important visualization so we can make smarter financial decisions.
Putting the right data back to the customer, you know, it sounds a lot like the relationship loyalty component as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we can start making contextual decisions at the point of sale. We can start making a decision about whether we can afford something, etc. But what this has done is a digital disruptor like Mint.com has come in and really raised our expectations as consumers. Now, there's a disconnect today between what they are offering us across channels and what the consumer is expecting. And when a mint.com comes in, even if they're not monetizing that innovation, it raises our expectations of what our bank should be offering us. They should be educating us both in the digital and the analog world about our spend, our investments, and adding a whole bunch of services so that they're not being commoditized by digital disruptors.
Is there bleed that takes place from one industry to another? Not specifically talking about banking here, but have you seen other practices in this respect, you know, in retail or in other businesses, in travel or something, where some of these best practices bleed over to other industries?
In terms of the innovation, in terms of the convergence of the analog and the digital?
Well, expectations of customers, you know, the digitized mind, as you say.
Yeah, I think, you know, one other space, I say that, you know, really because of mobilization and smartphones, what we're seeing is people are taking their life matters into their own hands. An example is pharmaceutical. So in the field of diabetes, for example, leading pharmaceutical companies now have an adapter for iPhones where people can monitor their blood sugar levels. This leads to smarter decision making every meal and every time someone has to take their medicines. Now, this is critical in terms of pharmaceutical companies being successful in the drug administration, and it's critical for diabetes sufferers' health because adherence and compliance with that regimen is critical. Now, what finance players or retail banks can learn from that is that by educating and being in people's pockets all of the time, being in their smartphones is a critical opportunity to impact us at all the important decision-making times, whether that be mealtime, shopping, or making an investment or deciding on a mortgage.
Great. All right. So listen, Anders, let's take a quick break, and we'll invite David into the conversation, and but please stick around, because we definitely, if we don't get you in on the next segment, we'll definitely get you in on the last segment to sort of further that discussion. Okay.
Cool.
Great. So you're with Brett King. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We're talking the marriage of analog and digital customer experiences. We'll be right back after this break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficient for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's KONY.com/BK.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. You're with Brett King. We're talking, the digital disruption of the customer experience, and we're talking analog expectations versus digital expectations. It's going to be a very interesting show. But I want to change tact a little bit here. David Thomas, we're going to introduce into the show at this point. David's called in all the way from Canberra, and it's bright and early in the morning. David, what time is it in the part of the world you are?
It's just 6:25 in the morning, Brett.
I hope you got your coffee.
Not quite.
Well, welcome to the show. So David's a consultant in the Asia Pacific region, working with a number of multinationals and corporates on expansion strategies into the region. He's spending a lot of time working on the interface of businesses going into China at the moment. So David, just before the show, as we were talking about this, we figured out in common that we'd both spent a bit of time in Hong Kong, but you spent a fair bit of time on the road, I gather.
Yes, definitely. And I'm very focused on the emerging markets in the world, particularly the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. But right now, China is a major focus.
Right. So in terms of the work that you're doing in China, what do you think that's, is coming out of China that could be really disruptive in the West in terms of new things that we're seeing? Obviously, we're obviously very interested in the banking and payment space on this show, but, feel free to introduce other ideas. What's happening in places like China that where they could be really setting the lead for the rest of the world?
Well, China is being very disruptive in many industries, and it's almost a microcosm, if you like, for some of the things that you and Anders have been talking about. The e-commerce space, for example, is just exploding. There's 250 million e-commerce shoppers in China, and they're changing the way that retailers...
250 million.
Million, yeah. E-commerce shoppers in China. I often say that China is modernizing, it's not westernizing. I think that's a really important point because they're not just taking the West's sort of way of doing things and applying them. They're actually challenging what we do in the West and trying to do it much better. And that creates a really interesting market for those of us who are interested in what the future might look like.
Of course, it's reading also some massive organizations. Tell us about a few of the really interesting big players in the e-commerce space in China.
Well, the biggest and the most probably the most fascinating is Alibaba, which actually just recently announced its intention to list on Wall Street.
It's going to be the biggest IPO ever, apparently, right?
Yes, and it's the biggest e-commerce firm in the world, you know, bigger than all of the others put together. It's changing everything. Alibaba sort of spinning off lots of sub brands like Alipay, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, which is definitely a threat to the banking system. And of course, many of its competitors are now starting to look quite interesting as well, like Tencent, which is another China-based e-commerce company.
Yep. The guys behind WeChat, which is taking off.
Yep. Very. I don't know how popular WeChat is in America, but it's becoming very popular in this part of the world. Everybody communicates on WeChat.
It's actually bigger there, bigger in that part of the world than WhatsApp, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, much much bigger. WhatsApp is not really not really used in this part of the world.
So. In terms of Alibaba, you know, they started off doing B2B stuff. In fact, I'll tell you an interesting story. I used to judge this the Asian Internet Awards, which were put on by Fairfax Group in Asia, and we presented an award to Jack Ma in 2001 for up and coming internet business.
Wow.
And I met Jack. He was the nicest guy. But of course, back then he was, the business was worth maybe millions. It was only just starting, and it was obviously, you know, fairly early days. It's a long time since then. But he's done really well with it.
Yes, I've met him as well. He's a lovely man. Really humble, modest. He doesn't appear to set the world on fire. But he is in every respect.
So tell us about the sort of e-commerce stuff that's really hot in China. What are the things that people buy in China through e-com?
Well, they're buying everything now. It started off in the sort of traditional space, but now it's everything from apparel and accessories where it sort of started. I've been to Alibaba's headquarters in Hangzhou in China, in eastern China, and they have this massive screen which is there to sort of attract and interest foreigners, where you can see in real time, you know, goods and services and products moving around the world. And it's extremely spectacular, like second by second, to see, you know, stuff moving everywhere. But about 68% of e-commerce is still in that sort of apparel and accessories space. The rest is in household goods, digital goods, consumer electronics, then about a third in books and audio, and now 30% in cosmetics and beauty. But the fastest growing area is in food. I've been doing some work recently with Australia's citrus industry, and we've developed a relationship with a group in Shanghai called Shanghai Fruit Day, and they're starting to sell Australian food products online direct to premium consumers in Shanghai. They have 300,000 subscribers, and they're changing the dynamics of the way in which food is distributed into the China market.
And what's the mix in terms of e-com over desktop versus mobile commerce? Have you got any appreciation of that?
Yes, it's about 40% is now e-commerce. And growing quite rapidly. Jack Ma, actually, talking about Jack Ma, always used to say that in the West, mainly in America, I suppose, retail shopping is generally, he generally regards the bricks and mortar stores as the main course, with e-commerce as the dessert. He says in China, we don't really have bricks and mortar, so e-commerce is the main course. And so everybody's being driven online to do their shopping. And the other thing to remember is it's a very crowded place, China. You spend a lot of time in Europe. It's not like you can go out very much. And when you do, you're often in polluted environments. A lot of people spend large numbers of hours online.
So there's it's almost as if this new middle class, you know, the middle class consumer that's growing so rapidly in China is growing up learning to buy or learning to engage with retail through digital.
Yeah, and that's the only way they know how to shop.
So, of course, because this is obviously a huge platform, Alibaba being the largest, tell us about the Alipay initiative and how that's come along and where that's at. Because there's been some debate on the whole QR code payment area and so forth recently in China, but it's obvious it's making some impact.
Yes, well, Alipay is now well in excess of PayPal in terms of its use. I think about three times PayPal's size now. There's 300 million registered users on Alipay and 100 million mobile users. So Alipay is becoming the sort of preferred method of payment in China, and everybody uses it. They've also gone offline, so you're now able to, as you say, use barcodes in the stores, and when banks are closed, as they are over various holiday periods, you can then make all your payments via Alipay. The other point to make about China and some of its differences to the West is that they don't like credit. They're not big credit card users. It's right. All debit cards. It's almost a face thing. They want to show you they've got the money, whereas credit card implies that you don't have the money. You're having to borrow it to spend. China doesn't have a credit card culture. It's very much a debit card. So they have a lot of prepaid systems, you know, wallets, e-commerce wallets, where you put the money in advance and then use it to spend it in a sort of stored value basis. And that creates enormous opportunities for people like Alibaba just because of the weight of money on overnight call.
I wonder how much cash they hold. Have you got any sort of ideas on that?
I think the latest I've heard in Alipay is 150 billion.
Wow. Yeah, that's in RMB or in USD? Yeah, RMB. It's still a lot of money.
Oh, it's a huge amount of money, and it's just started. And I think we're going to see that number probably double every year.
Right. So, yeah, if we were to sort of translate that to US dollars, it's probably in the order of 25 to 30 billion US dollars sort of daily cash flow that they hold in the Alipay system, which, you know, we've seen other successful things like that here in the US, like Starbucks card, you know, running $2 billion in deposits on their system and so forth and growing. But the 100 million mobile commerce users using Alipay, that would have to be the biggest closed-loop mobile payment system in the world, by my calculation.
Some way, I should think, yeah.
Yeah, so could you see, one of the things China's had trouble doing, and this is, I've been impressed with WeChat because it's the first thing that they've really been able to export. But do you see that Alipay could be exported, to the West?
Yes, and I think already it is, particularly with Chinese tourists starting to travel overseas and using their Alipay wallet. And I think Alipay are now trying to do deals with bricks and mortar stores around the world to help their customers who are Chinese tourists shop when they're overseas. And what they're finding, particularly in Asia, it probably hasn't spread to America yet, and it's starting to come to Australia. What they're finding is that once these stores see the benefit of using Alipay for their Chinese tourist customers, they start offering it to their local customers.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? It's very, very interesting. Tell us about Alibaba's relationship with the banking system in China. Do you have a read on that?
Well, I think they're independent of the banking system. I think they're trying to disrupt the banking system, and I think they're doing a very good job of it.
And is that creating some contentiousness in the market?
Not that I've heard of. China is such a big market. There's so many people in China, and they're becoming richer quickly that there's still plenty of business to go around. So there's not much cannibalization going on. I think the market's just getting bigger.
It's just net growth.
And everything's getting bigger. So at the moment, there's plenty of room for new players. I don't think it's reached anywhere near saturation point yet.
Well, go ahead.
One of the things I say is that 7 years ago, if you think back to the Beijing Olympics, it doesn't seem very long ago, China's economy was half the size it is today, just 7 years ago. In another 10 years, China's economy will have doubled, and then it will double again in the 10 years after that. So in 20 years' time, China's economy will be four times the size it is today. It's already a big economy. It's the second largest in the world after the US. But think of it being four times bigger in just 20 years' time. And imagine the disruption that that's going to cause globally. Mm. And imagine the impact China's going to have globally. And I think we've only just seen the beginning of that. And this current five-year plan, which is all about going out and starting to do things like Alibaba are doing, which is listing in the US, you can see that China's going to have an impact everywhere.
It's interesting because we sometimes wonder why these Chinese businesses haven't taken their businesses offshore, and we assume that it's a competency issue or it's a language issue or they just don't feel as comfortable in Western markets as they are in China. But the fact of the matter is there's so much growth happening for them in China, and it is their home market. Why would they look beyond those markets until they've sort of tapped out all of that growth?
That's right. But they are diversifying. We're starting to see Chinese companies list in Australia. I think that's a trend we're going to see a lot more of. Of course, ultimately, they all want to list on Wall Street, but in some ways, maybe Hong Kong, Singapore, Australia are sort of stepping stones to get there.
Mm. So in terms of the work you do with other organizations looking to get into China, how do they, from a cultural perspective, what are some of the things that you find that companies need to get their head around when they're coming into China, into that environment?
Well, so many, Brett. And culture is the biggest hurdle for everybody on both sides. For example, a small example is the way that we think. We tend to think short-term cycles, quarterly reporting, monthly this, weekly that. In China, they think in decades cycles. And that causes problems, from the beginning, because we're always looking for a result, and we're looking to make things happen too fast sometimes. And they're looking more to build a relationship, a trusted long-term relationship that they can work with over time. And that I come across that kind of problem all the time. We're too impatient, and they're taking their time, and both sides are getting frustrated with the other.
Mm, very interesting. So tell us about are there some interesting consumer trends that seem to be emerging in China that are differentiated in terms of the way people are using their smartphone to buy things? Can you talk to that?
The biggest change I'm seeing, as I said earlier, is in the food space. China is a very polluted country at the moment. It's going through an industrial revolution, which means that that it's not comfortable at many levels. We know in the West that industrial revolutions can take a long time and create a lot of problems on the ground. And so it's one thing to be buying a plasma TV or an iPhone, but it's another thing to be buying food and putting it in your mouth. Yeah. And so what I'm saying is getting access to high-quality, safe food from countries that provide good regulation, where you can have confidence in the quality and the taste and the long-term benefits of the product. They're looking to get their hands on it, and they're willing to pay three, four, five times the price.
Wow.
In the quality. And a lot of in that space is being driven online now, and that creates a very interesting market.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the pollution in Beijing and Shanghai, and I was in Shanghai a few weeks ago, and the pollution in Shanghai is not as bad as in Beijing, but it was still much worse than what you'd see in most other capital cities. It's interesting that the pollution may be a huge driver for mobile and e-commerce.
Because people stay in their homes, they don't go out, so they go online.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, David, look, let's just take a quick break, and then after the break we'll invite Anders back and we'll see if we can sort of not reach some consensus, but have a bit of a chat about where we're going to be 5 to 10 years from now on this global scene in terms of consumer behavior and some of these trends and where China might lead the rest of the world. You can stick around?
Great.
Great. All right, so you're with Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We'll be right back after this short break.
the business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Attend Payments 2014 to meet the forward-thinking leaders and disruptors who are transforming how we pay and get paid. Get a glimpse into the next wave of payments innovations and challenges through fast-paced interactive demonstrations, educational sessions, and a buzzing exhibit hall. Register now at payments.nacha.org. Payments 2014 is presented by NACHA, the Electronic Payments Association, the recognized leader in payment system education. The Payments Conference, transform imagination into strategic innovation. Register today at payments.nacha.org.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. This is our final segment for today. It's Thursday, April the 3rd. We're speaking to you from really around the world today. I'm here in New York. We have David calling from Canberra in Australia and Anders from Stockholm in Sweden. So a really international globe-trotting show today. This part of the show, guys, at the end of the show, I always like to sort of put the thinking hats on and sort of think about 5 to 10 years out, particularly in respect to banking and payments, how some of these changes and behaviors that we're seeing, where they're going to take us, you know, what's that future going to be like? Because if we know the end state and we know where we're going, then we can sort of figure out what we have to do to get there. So maybe, Anders, let's start with you. In terms of some of these trends that we're seeing in terms of showrooming and the retail environment, obviously a number of retail stores, really suffering. We've got one here in the United States now, American Apparel, who's struggling, and others. There's another Abercrombie and Fitch is another one that's going through some trouble right now. Are we going to see the death of retail entirely, or over the next 5 to 10 years? How are you expecting consumer habits to sort of pan out?
Well, I think there's some trends, and there's always with any trend a counter trend as well. I'll start with a major trend. That's to look at the younger demographics. If we look towards Generation Z, for example, or kids born between 1994 and 2010, the bad news for businesses is if you thought that Generation Y or the millennials were a little bit eccentric, the next generation is going to be even stranger when it comes to digital consumption and digital decision-making behaviors. In Sweden today, for example, half of all three-year-olds are online. And across the Western world today, according to AVG IT Security, more 2 to 5 year olds know how to play Angry Birds on their mobile phones than know how to tie their shoelaces.
That's a great stat.
and for these guys, a magazine or a newspaper on the floor, it's simply an iPad that doesn't work, right? They try and swipe it, etc. So for them, they're born digital. They think digital and they speak technology without an accent. They're digital natives. For them, the idea of walking into a bank branch because they have to sign something with a pen, it's going to be totally foreign to them.
Yeah, in fact, I'll give you another really good stat. A quarter of university students coming out of the US and European university system today don't have a signature. They don't, because they've never had to sign. They already live in a digital world. What do they have to sign for? Maybe they've had to sign their admissions paper, but you know, the probably the first thing they have to sign for is opening a bank account or signing a apartment lease or something like that. It's just a skill they don't normally need to use in their day to day life.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I was speaking at a mortgage conference just a few weeks ago in Sydney, Australia, and people are still resisting this idea of digital signatures or online verification in a world where a lot of people don't even have signatures or analog signatures anymore. So, I mean, you know, that's the longer term trend if we look towards demographics. But then the sort of the counter trend is that there's still a symbolic value, I believe, in the physical and the bricks and mortar, in the analog. I mean, the upmarket banks, like the Swiss banks, still pride themselves on having, checkbooks without stubs. Mont Blanc pens are enjoying a renaissance because we still like to sign a big check with our, you know, fashionable Mont Blanc pens.
But so is that just the last vestiges of the baby boomer and Gen X behavior here, sort of harking back to the good old days? Or are millennials and, you know, Gen Zs, are they going to have this view that, well, this antiquated, instrument, the pen, is something that I might start to use because it's fashionable or different?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's still a little bit of a symbol, right? But I think when it comes down to things like your first mortgage, who are you going to trust, your parents? Yes, you might do all your due diligence digitally leading up to the signature or whatever it happens to be, or the connection. But I think there are certain touch points, certain financial decisions. It's often said that, you know, buying your house is your life's biggest investment. Yeah. And I think people still crave a little bit of trust, a little bit of guidance in this. And I don't think that that's necessarily going to be so hugely different. Now, it may not involve the same kind of paperwork or the same struggles with straight-through processing or six-week settlements and all of these kind of things that are sort of caused by friction. But I think there's still going to be a human connection at the decisive banking moments in life. And banks just need to choose which ones are they going to digitize and which ones are they not going to digitize.
Okay. All right. Well, I partially agree with that. We could debate that, obviously. But David, in terms of sort of the banking space, in China, we're starting to see some really interesting things. In fact, there's a lot of talk about Bitcoin right now, but of course the early disruptor currency or digital currency was QQ coins in China, doing that as, you know, with Tencent, back as early as 2006, 2007. So are we going to see some disruptions out of China with, let's face it, they're going to have a middle class alone that's bigger than the entire population of the United States. So we've got some really interesting, marketplace forces working there to develop. Are we going to see a different type of consumer emerge out of China and different type of banking system?
Oh, I think so, yes. And their banks are rather lumbering old state-owned enterprises, which are definitely not going to be able to, keep pace with the sort of changes we're talking about. The other thing is that the internet penetration in China is still quite low compared to the rest of the world. In the US, I think it's about 80% now. And I think in Australia, it's similar. In Europe, I think it's maybe a bit less, at 60-odd%. China is only 40%. And India is actually only 11%.
Right.
So
where the mobile comes into play, right?
Yes, and definitely. I think we're going to see these numbers increase rapidly over the next 10 years or so, as China's economy increases, expands as well. And I see the old style banks in China are going to really struggle.
So what about Alibaba? Would they get into selling you financial products?
Yeah, and they already are. You can buy managed funds, you can buy insurance products through Alipay, they're already offering, totally outside the banking system, they're already offering financial services products.
Because they started offering lines of credit for businesses that were on their platform some time ago. That was, I guess, 3-4 years ago, but I didn't know they're in the consumer finance space already.
Definitely, yeah. No, and I think that's a very fast growing area for them.
Wow, that's incredible. So, you know, you've got this, it started off as a payments network. That's one thing that PayPal hasn't done, I don't think, as effectively. They've started offering some credit facilities, bill me later and so forth. But it sounds like Alipay and Alibaba is well ahead of the curve on that front.
They are.
So do they have a banking license, Alibaba?
No, they don't.
So they just do through partners?
Yes, that's right. They partner up with various like Ping An, the big insurance company. They've partnered up with them. They're partnering at the moment.
So do you think that organizations like Ping An see this as a huge new distribution opportunity?
Absolutely, yeah. With hundreds of millions of users, they do. I think Alibaba's biggest threat is other e-commerce providers. You know, Tencent, I would think, would be a major threat to Alibaba. We talked about the WeChat platform, which is taking off. That's something Alibaba will be worrying about, actually, the fact they don't have their own sort of social media chat-type environment to bring their customers to. I think they'll be very worried about that.
Very, very interesting. So, Anders, tell me about what's next for you and the Digilog story.
Well, I think really where successful brands are operating at the moment, some people call it multi-channel, some people call it omni-channel. I like to call it the Digilog, of course. It's this fusion of the digital and the analog. And successful brands, be it in retail or be it in retail banking, for example, they exist in that world where they're kind of trying to bridge the real and the physical with the digital and the kind of cyber or virtual realities that we used to think of as the future, but the difference is now we're living it. And so I'm studying very closely brands that are managing this sort of seamless integration across multiple different channels. And this is everything from the Internet of Things, so devices speaking to one another, to really clever marketing campaigns through augmented reality in retail, for example. IKEA is a good example of this. One of their latest catalogs, for example, went very Digilog. IKEA used to...
Give us an example. What did they combined digital...
One of their biggest brand assets has been the IKEA catalog, one of the biggest contributors to the high Western divorce rate. This catalog is something people really crave and look forward to. In fact, IKEA gets complaints if it gets delivered a week late. So they have to kind of keep this physical analog piece that gets delivered to us via snail mail. And so when they thought about how do we innovate around that, how do we engage a younger consumer, and how do we print this item, and they print more IKEA catalogs than the Gideons ship the Bible around the world, which is a pretty large number. But they're going, how do we keep that relevant? And so now through Layer and through augmented reality, when you receive your catalog, well, you chuck it down on the floor in your living room, and through your phablets or your tablets or your mobile devices, the catalog starts interacting with you digitally. So you can select Billy the Bookcase, and Billy the Bookcase will come alive to scale in your living room. So you get to see how all the furniture would come alive in your context based on your geolocation, and you get to change the color, etc., and interact with it in a way that's very Digilog. So they're converging the analog with the digital. They're keeping their brand asset of their catalog really relevant, but they're digitizing the experience to a degree that the analog never could before. And so I think this sort of contextual convergence of, what we used to think of as real and physical and the digital and the cyber is where really smart brands are, they're hanging out in the Digilog space.
So, David, what about some, from a technology perspective, what are some of the really interesting developments you see taking place? Obviously, there's so many different smartphones available, in the market in China. But, where do you see this going from a consumer market perspective in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I'm not an expert in this space, but I think I think you're right that WeChat and chat type platforms will become e-commerce platforms, and they're already talking about that. And I think I can only see that exploding. That that 1 minute you're chatting with your friend, the next minute you're buying something through your WeChat or your chat type program. So I think the mobile phone as your primary tool for e-commerce transactions, that's going to be the biggest driver.
Yeah, great. Okay, so David, tell us a little bit about who you're working with in terms of some of your clients and some of the work you're doing right now.
Well, I've spent the last 6 months working with the citrus industry, which has been very interesting in Australia. I've got to know up to 1,000 growers in Australia. It's a very fragmented industry, but we produce a very, very high class product, and China wants it and wants all of it. And one of our big challenges as a country across the whole food and agri sector, which is now becoming very interesting to China, is how on earth are we ever going to keep up with the demand for safe, good quality, with good taste type food coming from Asia? And unfortunately, we're just moving too slowly right now. We're going to have to find a game changer there, because we're never going to keep up if we don't start doing something about it now.
Yeah, China is going to maybe turn to a big consumption market of these types of products, not just exporting. Here is an interesting stat for you, David. 51% of Australian farmers have used online dating.
Well, I'll give you another stat. There's 135,000 farms in Australia, and 55% of them make less than $100,000 a year.
Wow.
So, we've got a real problem, real challenge ahead. When you compare that to, say, the mining and resources sector, where you've got big players like BHP and Rio, consolidated industries. In food and agri, which is the next big wave for us down in this part of the world, we're very fragmented.
Well, Jim Rogers, who's a guy I respect out of Singapore, he reckons the farmers, the guy is going to be driving the Lamborghinis in 10 years, because that's where all the money is going to be and where it's going to be really, really a challenge. So, David, look, thanks for joining us all the way and very early in the morning from Australia on the East Coast. We'd love to hear a little bit more about China at some point in the future. And Anders, thanks for calling in from Europe, from Stockholm. And, let us know how your next visit to IKEA goes.
Fantastic. Thank you. It's going to be in my living room.
There you go. Well, that's the show for this week. You've been listening to Breaking Banks. We'll look forward to joining you again next week and continuing the conversation on the disruption of the banking and payments industry globally. Thanks very much. I'm your host, Brett King. See you again next week. Bye.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.